Good afternoon. I'm going to call this meeting of the Committee on Taxes to order for April 17th, 2024. First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes from April 11th, 2024. Vice Chair Norris, do I have a motion?
Chair Gomez, I move adoption of the minutes from the April 11th meeting.
Vice Chair Norris has moved adoption of the April 11th minutes. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed, nay. Motion carries. The minutes for April 11th, 2024 are adopted. So just a couple of notes about this week. So today we're going to the omnibus tax bill, or no, I'm not supposed to call it an omnibus. Okay. If anybody's listening that talks to the speaker, don't tell her I said that. The House 2024 tax bill was posted last night. And so today we're meeting and we're going to do an overview and a walkthrough with nonpartisan staff. The schedule for the rest of the week is that tomorrow we will be taking testimony on the bill from the public. And on Friday we will do markup, member discussion, and hopefully adoption of the bill or movement of moving the bill. So with that, I think we'll just turn it over to nonpartisan staff. We're going to start with Article 1. Mr. Williams, Mr. Klayman, take it away.
Chair Gomez and members for the record, I'm Sean Williams from House Research. I'm going to be discussing Article 1, the income and corporate franchise taxes article. Section 1 of the article is the bill pertaining to the political contribution refund. So that bill permits the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board to access data entered by campaign treasurers into the electronic reporting system provided by the board. This is part of the provisions related to establishing an electronic filing system for the political contribution refund. That section also classifies data maintained by the board as private data. Section 2 of the bill requires the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board to provide electronic receipts rather than paper receipts to political parties and candidates. And it also requires the board to provide a receipt validation report to the Commissioner of Revenue. And my colleague, Mr. Klayman, will discuss Section 3.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Chris Klayman from the House Research Department. Section 3 is the beginning farmer bill from Representative Vang that modifies the set-aside expiration dates for sales or rentals to be beginning farmers that are also emerging farmers. Section 4 is the corporate franchise tax return disclosure bill from Representative Greenman, and that requires disclosure of corporate franchise tax returns by corporations having over $250 million in gross domestic sales, and that provision is effective for disclosures due January 1st, 2025.
Chair Gomez and members, Section 5 pertains to the child credit. This is a section that just requires taxpayers who received an advanced child credit payment to file an income tax return for that year. Section 6 is a bill pertaining to the direct filing of individual returns, so it requires the Department of Revenue to establish a free filing system. And similar to the amended language we heard in committee, the system has to include a sufficient number of tax forms. The commissioner estimates 70% of returns could be filed with the system. Section 7 pertains to discharges of indebtedness and situations of coerced debt. So people who took on debt because they were forced to or coerced to, if those debts are discharged, the income would be excluded from taxable income through an income tax subtraction. Section 8 is modifications, again, to the political contribution refund system. It prohibits the commissioner from issuing a refund in excess of the maximum refund amount under law. It requires refund claims to be submitted using the electronic filing system the bill establishes, and it also sets a minimum claim amount of $10. Section 9 also pertains to the child credit. This is the provision allowing 18-year-old children to qualify for the larger credit amount for younger children. Section 10 pertains to the advance payments of credits. So under current law, the Department of Revenue has authority to make those payments permissibly, and Section 10 would make that a mandatory requirement. Section 11 is the minimum child credit, similar to what the governor had in the governor's bill. The House bill limits the credit only to those who received the advance payments, so the governor's bill would have applied that credit to everyone. The House bill also is not limited based on income, so any taxpayer who received an advance payment of the child credit would be eligible for the minimum credit amount. This section also establishes an account in the special revenue fund that is used to sort of prepay for 2 years of the credit in fiscal year 26 and 27. Section 12 of the bill is another change pertaining to 18-year-olds qualifying for the younger child credit. This just removes them from the older child credit. And Section 13 is my colleague, Chris, Mr. Clemens.
Madam Chair and members, Section 13 is the housing tax credit bill from Representative Tabke, allowing rollovers of unused allocation amounts for that credit. This bill's been modified from when it was heard in this committee. In the DE amendment, it only allows a one-year rollover from unused allocations in 2023 to tax years 2024. Section 14 is the Section 530 bill relating to employee classification from Representative Greenman. This is the bill that would decouple Minnesota from the federal Section 530 safe harbor for certain employment status determinations.
Chair Gomez and members, Section 15 is another provision pertaining to coerced debt. This just would exclude those debts from the income measure used to calculate the homestead credit refund.
Madam Chair, members, Section 16 is the corporate tax base erosion study, Representative Howard bill. And this would require the Department of Revenue to produce a study on corporate tax base erosion and also legislative options and some other items that the state or that the legislature has for addressing that erosion. The report would be due January 1st, 2025.
Chair Gomez and members, Section 17 is an appropriation session for the electronic political contribution refund system. It's $147,000 in fiscal 25, and then the base is set at a lower amount for fiscal year 26 and 27. Section 18 is an appropriation for the direct free file system we discussed earlier in the bill. It's a $5 million appropriation in fiscal 25, and then the base is set in fiscal year 27. That section also transfers money from the tax filing modernization account in the special revenue fund to the general fund. And then Section 19 of the bill just repeals that tax filing modernization account because the money is being transferred out into the general fund in the previous section. And members, that concludes the discussion of Article 1. I don't know if we're going to take questions now or at a later time or how you want to handle that.
Yeah, excuse me. I think taking questions as we go, I'm good with. We'll maybe pause at the end of each article or each article and see if there are member questions.
So specifically on Article 1?
Yes. So, yeah, so and so we'll have like a full, you know, member discussion on Friday, but just if there are technical questions, clarifying questions for our nonpartisan staff while they're up there here presenting, happy to take those now. Looks like there aren't any, so thank you so much. Oh, Representative Anderson.
Sorry, very quickly. On the political campaign, paying refund, it says effective for contributions made on or after December 31. Is that after December 31 or is that just, I didn't read the, I mean, I haven't read the language in the bill. Does that make, you know, because a lot of people donate on the 31st of December, but that would be.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Gomez and Representative Anderson, if you look at page 3 of the bill, section lines 3.3 and 3.4, it's effective for contributions made after December 31st, 2025, so I think it would be contributions beginning in 2026.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And similarly, I was on the brief for the refund of contributions to political parties and candidates.
Rep Kosnick, if you don't mind, just so we can all, could you just tell us the
section
you're looking
page
at?
Page 3 of the brief.
Okay, cool.
Down on section 8. It says, if a taxpayer's refund exceeds the maximum amount permitted by law, are we giving people bigger credits than they're allowed currently? Just want to understand that part.
Mr. Williams?
Chair Gomez and Representative Kosnick, I'm not sure if that language is needed to address a current issue with administrative or if it's more of a clarifying change. As I sort of read the current language, it says the maximum refund must not exceed $75 for a married couple filing jointly, and for a married couple must not exceed $150. So I would interpret that is already applying and sort of limiting their ability to give refunds beyond that amount. So this may just be kind of a clarifying change, but there is new language in the bill that says the commissioner must not issue a refund that exceeds the maximum refund amounts in that subdivision.
Representative Kosnick.
Okay, thank you. I'm guessing it's probably due to the new contribution refund limits.
I
was concerned that people were getting more than they were supposed to get, which obviously I don't think any of us would intend that. So thanks.
Yes, good question. Okay, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I had a question about the Section 18, the direct filing system. So would any of the responders who responded to the request for information meet the requirements in the bill to not otherwise provide paid individual tax filing services to Minnesotans?
Mr. Williams?
Chair Gomez and Representative Robbins, are you referring to the people that responded to that survey?
Yes, the request for information, yeah.
Chair Gomez and Representative Robbins, I'm not certain one way or another if which of those respondents would sort of meet that requirement that they not be offering paid tax preparation services in Minnesota that's in the bill. I could follow up with you after committee. I don't know if the responses I received were public as to which tax preparation services were responding to the survey, but I do know the Department of Revenue reached out to tax preparation companies, and probably some of them are offering services in the state already.
Yeah, and excuse me, Representative Robbins, so just the intention there was that, you know, we do understand that in order to implement this system that the Department of Revenue may have to contract with an outside firm, and we just wanted to make sure that in case that's the direction that they go, that firm that they select to build the direct file system isn't also providing those systems or those providing a program and making profit off of it in the state of Minnesota. So, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So maybe the question is more too. So my understanding is, like, in other states where they're trying this, is there such a group? Because most of the companies provide free tax filing services, but then they also have the paid option at the higher levels. Is there someone who does not provide a fee-for-service tax filing system that other states have used? Like, I just haven't seen it.
I mean, so this is about the entity that's going to build the
right.
Not operate, right? Because the idea is that the Department of Revenue will operate the system, but we don't want a for-profit entity that's currently operating in Minnesota to do that work for them. So they would have to find another entity to help build the system on the front end, if that makes sense.
Okay. So then do you know, because some of my concern is that the pilot is going on and we're kind of maybe getting the cart before the horse, so maybe you guys know or the chair knows, when the federal free file program, how are we going to know if we qualify for the next round, and should we wait for that to be part of the pilot, or do we know what the timing on how the federal pilot is going and our efforts to still get involved in that?
So we're going a little bit outside of technical questions,
sorry.
But I'm happy to there has not, my understanding is that there hasn't been a second round of the pilot announced yet. So, you know, that's of the federal, we're talking about the federal IRS direct file pilot right now, just for everybody's information. So, but the direction, you know, I as I said, when we presented this bill, every state that was chosen to participate in the first round of the federal pilot had an already existing direct file in for the state returns, and so we can't be certain about what the federal government's going to do. But the intent here is whether we get chosen for a future round of the pilot, whether the IRS pilot gets turned into a permanent program. Dozens of states around the country already have their own state-level direct file system, and so that was just the intent with this language. But, you know, as to, you know, whether we should or shouldn't wait until we, for some later point on to develop a Minnesota-based direct file system, that's a policy choice, not really a technical question, but happy to engage more on that when we have our full discussion on Friday.
I do have one more technical.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Representative Robbins.
Okay, thank you. And then the last question is how this will work. Will it pre-populate the information for filers based on their last adjusted gross income, or is that something they will manually redo? Like, will it save it year to year? Do you know how that will work?
Mr. Williams?
Chair Gomez and Representative Robbins, I think that the bill's sort of silent on that. It says to the extent possible, it needs to coordinate with the free file system offered by the federal government. But I think that it would sort of be, that would be sort of an implementation decision for the Department of Revenue if this provision was enacted.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions about Article 1 before we move on? All right, seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Klayman, Mr. Williams. Mr. Swanson, welcome.
Madam Chair and members, Jared Swanson with House Research. I'm going to move on to Article 2 of the bill, which is the Property Taxes and Local Government Aids article. So beginning with Section 1 of Article 2, Section 1 requires charitable organizations to occupy and provide services from a property in order to receive an exemption on the property if it is used to provide rental housing. Sections 2, 10, and 11 all relate to the attachments and appurtenances of electric utility co-ops provision that was heard in this committee earlier in session. This is the as the version of the bill as amended, and these provisions would clarify that except for substations and transmission or generation equipment, utility cooperatives' power distribution systems are exempt from property taxes. Section 3 provides a property tax exemption for 5 parcels of land owned by the Grand Portage Band. Section 4 provides a property tax exemption for a property in Minneapolis owned by the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. Section 5 increases the classification tier thresholds for Class 1C homestead resorts. Section 4 removes the requirement that community land trust property receiving the new 4D2 property tax classification be valued without regard to any restrictions that apply because the property is a community land trust. Section 7, 8, 9, and 12 through 17 all contain House File 4826 as amended in committee, and these provisions would establish the advanced homestead credit for seniors, which would pay a portion of eligible seniors' property tax refunds in the form of a property tax credit applied to the first half payment in May. Just continuing down the list in section order 7 or sections 8 and 9 apply to the advanced homestead credit for seniors. 10 and 11 I covered as the attachment and appurtenances provision and related to section 2, and then 12 through 17 again are provisions related to the advanced homestead credit for seniors. I'm not going to go into detail in all of these sections, but if members have questions, I'm happy to return to those provisions. So then jumping ahead to section 18, sections 18 through 21 would allow local units of government to abate property taxes on property that will be used for the development of affordable housing and on property held by a land bank organization for future development. Included in these sections is a requirement that the abatement be paid back if the land is ultimately used for a purpose other than the purpose given by the land bank prior to development. Sections 22 through 24 of Article 2 all relate to the local homeless prevention aid. So Section 22 would prohibit recipients of local homeless prevention aid from using the aid to cover the costs of removing individuals from encampments or for clearing an encampment. And Sections 23 and 24 would provide a one-time increase in 2024 of $5 million for local homeless prevention aid. And it would require the Commissioner of Revenue to recertify the aid in 2024. Section 25 of Article 2 allows the City of Stewart to receive a portion of its 2023 local government aid payment that was withheld, provided that by June 1, the State Auditor certifies that the City has submitted its required financial statements for calendar year 2022. Section 26 provides a property tax exemption for taxes paid in 2022 and a portion of taxes paid in 2021 on a property in Minneapolis that was purchased by the Red Lake Nation for the Red Lake Nation College. Now, this provision would also provide a state-paid refund to the property owner for the tax amount attributable to this exemption. Section 27 provides an appropriation of $158,000 in fiscal year 25 to the Commissioner of Revenue to administer the Advanced Homestead Credit for Seniors. And then finally, Section 28 repeals the expiration of local homeless prevention aid, which under current law is set to expire after aids are distributed in 2028. And Madam Chair, that concludes Article 2.
Great. Are there any questions on Article 2 from members before we move on to Article 3? Representative Anderson.
Thank you. So the senior advanced homestead credit is income based, correct?
Mr. Swanson?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, that's correct.
Representative Anderson.
So how is it going to work to add the advanced homestead credit for seniors to the proposed property tax statement? How is the local jurisdiction who sends these out, how are they going to know what someone's income is?
Mr. Swanson? I know this is it's a advanced payment, so it uses the previous year's income calculation, but we can pass it over to Mr. Williams for more detail.
Chair Gomez and Representative Anderson, for that provision, the claimant would file their homestead credit refund for a given year the sort of same way they would under current law, and then half that amount would be sort of applied to the following year's property tax bill, and then you would file a property tax refund return the next year and sort of reconcile the advance payment versus how much you actually received in your credit for that year. So it's sort of the credit that's applied to your property taxes is based on what you received the previous year and sort of you submitted to the Department of Revenue when you applied for your PTR.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. So on their property tax statement, it's typically says it's this much for school, all the different taxing jurisdictions. So what's it going to look like? Are we going to be saying that it's less, or is that going to show us a credit after you list all the different jurisdictions? Tax?
Mr. Swanson?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, that would show up as a property tax credit the same as other current property tax credits are shown, so just reducing the final overall tax amount.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Representative Anderson?
No, it would be interesting to see this. So.
Yeah, this is a bill that Representative Robbins brought forward, and pleased to include it, and I think it's an interesting bill, and we'll see kind of how it plays out, but
thank you.
Yeah, thank you. All right. So are there any other questions on Article 2 before we move on? Seeing none, Mr. Swanson, please go on with Article 3.
Madam Chair, members, Article 3 is the mineral taxes article. So beginning with Section 1, Section 1 along with Sections 5, 6, 8, and 9 would rename the Iron Range School Consolidation and Cooperatively Operated School account to the Iron Range School and Community Development account. This is a production tax distribution account. Section 9 contains the actual name change, and Sections 1, 5, 6, and 8 are all conforming changes related to the name change in Section 9. Section 2 increases the maximum taconite homestead property tax credit to $515. The credit is available to homesteads within the taconite relief area and is funded by taconite production tax revenues. Sections 3 and 4 of Article 3 would change how fiscal disparities is shown on both the proposed property tax statement and the regular property tax statement for commercial industrial property within the boundaries of the Iron Range Fiscal Disparities Program. Under these, both of these sections, the amount of tax shown for each jurisdiction on the statement would be equal to the jurisdiction's tax rate multiplied by the full net tax capacity of the property. An additional line on the statement labeled as the fiscal disparities adjustment would be equal to the actual tax paid by the property minus the sum of the amounts shown on the statement for each jurisdiction. For some properties, this adjustment line would be a positive number, and for other properties, this adjustment line would be a negative number. Section 5 of Article 3 is another conforming change related to the renaming of the account that I mentioned in Section 1. Section 6 is another such conforming change. Section 7 of Article 3 clarifies that the redirection of 10% of the gross proceeds tax to Aurora, Babbitt, Ely, Hoyt Lakes, Bowabic, and Embarrass Township for the first 5 years that distributions of the gross proceeds tax are made only applies to distributions of taxes paid by a mining operation that's located within the taconite assistance area as it was defined prior to the changes to that definition that were enacted in 2023. Again, Sections 8 and 9 are related to the name change. Section 10 increases the taconite production tax distribution to the Range Association of Municipalities and Schools from 0.3 cents per taxable ton up to 0.5 cents per taxable ton. Section 11 increases the annual transfer of taconite production tax distribution from the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund to the Iron Range Consolidation and Cooperatively Operated School account, which again is renamed in Section 9. Both of these are production tax distribution accounts, and under current law, $3.5 million is annually transferred between these two accounts. This provision would increase the amount that's annually transferred between 2024 and 2036. Section 12 of Article 3 increases from $15,000 to $25,000 the amount of the taconite production tax distribution to the taconite municipal aid account that is annually transferred to Brighton Township. Section 13 of Article 3 is related to the bonding provisions in Sections 14 and 15. So this section clarifies that the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund may be used to fund reserve accounts to secure payments of the bonds authorized in both of those sections. Those bonds are repaid from the Iron Range Consolidation and Cooperatively Operated School account. So Section 14 is one of those bond provisions, and this section would require the Commissioner of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation to issue up to $49 million in bonds in 2024 to fund grants for a variety of projects. The bond payments, again, would be made from the production tax distribution distributions to the Iron Range Consolidation and Cooperatively Operated School account. I'm not going to list all the projects under that section, but members can find a list of the projects in Subdivision 3 of Section 14, and that's on page 55 of the DE. Section 15 would require the Commissioner of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation to issue up to $31 million in bonds in 2025 to fund grants for a variety of projects. Similar to the previous section, these bonds would be paid for by the production tax distributions to the Iron Range Consolidation and Cooperatively Operated School account. And the projects are again in Subdivision 3 of this section, which is on page 60 of the DE amendment. Lastly, Section 16 of Article 3 provides a one-time transfer of $300,000 from the 2024 distribution to the Taconite Economic Development Fund. The transfer would go to the City of Chisholm for the Senator David Thomasoni Bridge of Peace. And Madam Chair, that concludes Article 3.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Moving to member questions, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at Article 3, page 54. And I see some language I've never seen before. It says the uses listed are not subject to review or recommendation by the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board. To Mr. Swanson, then who reviews them?
Mr. Swanson?
Madam Chair and Representative Davids, so under this provision as written, there would be no ability for the board to make any changes to the distributions as they're listed in this section. So the amounts that are shown in Section 14 and as well in Section 15 would need to be paid by the Commissioner of the IRRR, in the amounts shown within this provision.
Representative
well,
Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So the Commissioner has to pay them but had no say about what they were. Is that correct, Mr. Swanson?
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and Representative Davids, so the Subdivision 1 does require that the grants be used for the purposes stated within the bill language, and the grant recipients do need to apply to the Commissioner stating that they will use the funds for the purposes listed, but it is up to the Commissioner to administer the grants.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So he administers the grants that the board had nothing to say about. So this is quite troubling to me, actually, because then you go to the next page, and maybe when fiscal gets up here, be ready for this question. On page 55, line 55.9, it says Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund must make up the deficiency. So we're figuring there's going to be a deficiency. So that's not for right now, Madam Chair, but when we get to the fiscal folks, I'd like to know what the projected deficiency would be. So what you have here is the tax committee writing a bonding bill. but it's revenue bonds, so you don't have to have the three-fifths. I understand that. But I've never seen anything like this. The uses listed are not subject to review or recommendation. So it just comes out of the sky. So the tax committee is deciding bonding projects. That's troubling, but we'll talk about it later. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative Lissegaard, we're going to have a full conversation on Friday, but if you have...
Madam Chair, I'd just like to say...
Representative Lissegaard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just ask, do they have to reporting, and do anybody that receives anything from the IRRRB or the board through this, do they have to follow a process and meet certain criteria?
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and Representative Lissegaard, yes, Subdivision 1 of both of these sections they do require the recipients of the grants to submit a plan to the commissioner of the IRRR. The commissioner is able to have say over whether the plan submitted meets the requirements of the grant uses that are in Subdivision 3.
Thank you. All right. I'm not seeing any other questions about Article 3. Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Welcome, Ms. Hagler. Moving on to, I think you're covering 4 through 7. 4 through 8. Great. Whenever you're ready.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, Alex Hagler from House Research. Starting with Article 4, this contains the sales tax, gross receipts tax, and special taxes provisions. Section 1 is from the governor's bill, and it establishes a permanent 0.5% credit rate for the provider tax research credit. Sections 2 through 5 relate to the creation of a gross receipts tax on offering for play amusement devices. And these sections come from House File 4575 and was amended in committee. And the substance of the provisions are unchanged, but the effective date was pushed back to October 1st, 2024. Sections 6 and 8 relate to the repeal of the illegal cannabis and controlled substances tax. And those are also unchanged from how they were heard in committee earlier this year. And then lastly, Section 7 provides a sales tax construction materials exemption for the city of Woodbury. And this provision was modified to provide the exemption for materials purchased after January 31, 2024 through July 1, 2025. And Madam Chair, that concludes Article 4.
Thank you, Ms. Hagler. Are there any questions on Article 4? Not seeing any, please proceed.
Madam Chair and members, Article 5 contains the tax increment financing provisions that were in the division report, and many of the provisions have been modified from how they were in the report, so I'll just go through them. Section 1 amends a special law for the city of Ramsey and provides an extension of the requirement that the city pass a resolution detailing interfund loan transfers, and that extension is good through the end of this year. Section 2 amends a special law for the city of Maple Grove and extends the five-year rule by an additional 5 years and extends the duration of the district by an additional 5 years. Section 3 provides an extension of the five-year rule for the city of St. Paul for the Ford Site Development District to a total of 10 years. Section 4 authorizes the City of Brooklyn Center to establish redevelopment districts within a designated project area. Any district that is established is deemed to meet the blight requirements that are statutorily required for redevelopment districts, and then deems any increments spent within the district to be spent on blight correction. Sections 5 through 7 are the provisions from Brooklyn Park that were heard in this committee that allow the city to establish redevelopment districts within three distinct project areas. And these provisions were modified to only provide the authority for the districts to be deemed to meet the blight requirements and have any increment spent to be deemed on blight correction and an extension of the five-year rule to 10 years. The value capture provision that was in the original bill as was heard in committee is not in this bill. Section 8 authorizes the city of Eden Prairie to establish a redevelopment district in an area that encompasses the Eden Prairie Mall. And again, these districts would be deemed to meet the blight requirements, and then any increment spend would be deemed spent on blight correction. And this provision was unchanged from the division report. Sections 8 and 9 provide five-year rule extensions to the city of Edina for two TIF districts, and also a duration extension for those districts. Sections 11 and 12 provide five-year extensions for the five-year rule for the city of Moorhead and Minnetonka. And Section 3 authorizes the city of Plymouth to establish redevelopment districts, and again, are deemed to meet the blight requirements, and increment spent would be deemed to be spent on blight correction. And there is also an extension of the five-year rule in this provision. And then lastly, Section 14 authorizes the city of St. Cloud to establish a redevelopment district that is deemed to meet the blight requirements, and increment spent would be deemed to be spent on blight correction. And then there is authority for the city to spend increment on public infrastructure that is adjacent to but outside the boundaries of the district. And that concludes the TIF article.
Thank you, Ms. Hagler. Are there any questions on Article 5, TIF? Okay. All right, not seeing any, please proceed.
Madam Chair and members, Article 6 is the local sales tax article and contains the contents of Chair Gomez's House File 5335 that we heard in committee a few days ago. The provision has been modified from how the bill was heard in committee. It includes public safety facilities such as correctional facilities, district courts, and law enforcement centers to be included in the list of projects that a city or county may impose a tax to fund. There's also a provision that requires DOR to expire a tax if the city or county does not comply with reporting requirements, or if the state auditor's office notifies DOR that tax revenue is being spent improperly. And then lastly, there was a modification to the 1% distribution for DOR to use for their administrative costs. The bill originally required them to use half of that revenue to maintain their zip code database, but the provision was modified to just say a portion must be used instead of requiring them to use half of the money. And I believe those were all of the changes to that bill for now, and that is the contents of the local tax article.
All right. Any questions on section or article 6 or article 6? Sorry. Seeing none, please proceed.
Madam Chair and members, article 7 contains the special local tax provisions that were part of the division report, and these provisions were unchanged. Sections 1 and 2 relate to accommodation intermediaries and require local lodging taxes to apply to the entire price of lodging charged to the customer, including cost of services provided by the accommodations intermediaries. Sections 3 and 4 relate to the food and beverage tax imposed by the city of Minneapolis that's within the boundaries of the downtown taxing district. Section 3 lowers the rate from 3% to 2.5%, and Section 4 expands the boundaries of the district to encompass more of the North Loop area. And that concludes the special local taxes article.
All right. Any questions on Article 7? Not seeing any. Article 8.
Madam Chair and members, Article 8 is the contents of the public finance bill, and these provisions were unchanged from how they were heard in committee.
Great. Any questions on Article 8? All right, not seeing any. Thank you so much, Ms. Hagler. Article 9, miscellaneous. I think we're getting Mr. Swanson and Mr. Williams maybe both back up. Oh, Representative Joachim, did you have a question? No. Oh, okay, sorry. Sorry, I misunderstood what Patrick was saying to me. Please proceed.
Chair Gomez and members, Section 1 of Article 9 is the sort of policy language related to the taxpayer assistance grants and tax outreach grants. One small modification is that the bill specifies that the grants provided are not subject to a percentage withholding by the Department of Revenue for administrative costs. Section 2 pertains to the solid waste tax. Under current law, a portion of that tax is dedicated to the environmental fund and is used for county grants to reduced or for waste reduction and recycling programs. And the bill would allocate for fiscal year 2025 only an additional $1.8 to $1 million. And my colleague, Mr. Swanson, is going to discuss Section 3.
Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair, members, Sections 3 through 7 would allow cities to establish land value taxation districts and reallocate property taxes within those districts on the basis of an alternative tax base, including reallocation of the taxes based solely on the value of the land underneath the properties within the district. That's what those sections sort of accomplish as a whole. If members want more detail on what each one of those does, I'm happy to go into more details. But otherwise, we'll move on with Mr. Williams on Section 8.
Chair Gomez and members, Section 8 is the aid to cities for Emerald Ash Borer financial assistance bill that we heard in committee last week. This language is similar to the DE2 amendment that we heard last week with a couple of changes. First, the appropriation is $1 million rather than $7, which is what we heard last week. In addition, the bill that we heard in committee gave the Department of Revenue the right to either establish a formula-based distribution of the funds or grant-based distribution, and the DE amendment would require DOR to use a grant-based distribution of those funds.
Moving on to Section 9 of Article 9, Section 9 would provide a grant of $50,000 in fiscal year 2025 to the Anoka County Soil and Water Conservation District. Section 10 of Article 9 appropriates $580,000 in fiscal year 2025 to the Browerview Public Schools as a grant to be used for the cost of materials and supplies related to new construction and renovations of a school building. Section 11 of Article 9 provides a grant of $100,000 in fiscal year 2024 to the City of South St. Paul for planning and development costs within the city.
Section 12 of Article 9 is the appropriation for tax credit outreach grants and taxpayer assistance grants. That's a $1 million appropriation in fiscal 25 with a slight increase in the tails for the outreach grants, and then $750,000 in fiscal 25 for the taxpayer assistance grants. And that concludes Article 9.
Great. Thank you. Any questions on Article 9? Not seeing any.
So, Chair Gomez and members, Articles 10 through, I believe, 13 is the last one, are the Department of Revenue's policy and technical bill. These are largely unchanged from what we heard in committee. There is one section pertaining to the Social Security subtraction in Article 10, the income and corporate article that has been removed in this draft.
Thank you. Are there any questions on Articles 10 through 13? All right, not seeing any. Thank you so much to the whole nonpartisan team. Turning now to the House fiscal overview, I'll invite Ms. Templin and Ms. Highmark up. Thank you. So we're moving now. They're going to walk us through the spreadsheet, which is also in your packets.
Good afternoon, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. My colleague, Ms. Highmark, and myself will be going through the spreadsheet that you have before you. The spreadsheet that we're working off of should have a timestamp of 11:07 a.m. Okay, good. All right, so before you, you have a 14-page spreadsheet. The first page, page one, is the summary page that highlights the general fund forecast for revenues and for property tax expenditures, and also gives the changes to the general fund accounts and the non-general fund accounts in the bill. Starting with on the first page, lines four through 10 show the changes in the tax bill. on line 5, there is an estimated general fund revenue reduction of $10.271 million in the fiscal 24 and 25 biennium, and an estimated revenue reduction of $32.230 million in the fiscal 26 and 27 biennium.
Moving to the to line 6, we look at the property tax refunds, aids, and credits. In fiscal year 24 and 25, we have a cost of $42.729 million. And in fiscal year 26 and 27, we have a cost savings of $27 million.
And line 7 through 10 identify the total cost in the bill of $53 million in fiscal 24 and 25 is the estimated revenue reduction to the general fund in that biennium, and in fiscal 26 and 27 the estimated revenue reduction is $5.230 million. Lines 8, 9, and 10 just reflect the committee's target and how the committee has met the target. Moving on, the first 5 pages. We will cover the tax changes in the bill to tax revenues. And in this section of the spreadsheet, positive numbers represent revenue gains and negative numbers represent revenue reductions or costs. So just something to keep in mind as we go through the bill. I'm just going to, on page 2, I'm just going to jump to the changes in the bill, starting on line 12 of the spreadsheet, 12 and 13. There are changes to the child tax credit. There are about 3 changes. One of them, Mr. Williams summarized, it's the inclusion of 18-year-olds. The second change is the minimum credit, and the there's no income cap. And then the other one is the opt-in for the minimum credit. The cost for these changes is on line 12 and 13, and in fiscal 24 and 25, the estimated revenue reduction is $7.8 million. And in fiscal 26 and 27, the sum of lines 12 and 13 is $32.3 million. I should also mention there are related provisions in other sections of the spreadsheet for these modifications. Moving on to line 14, this is the section 530 exclusion, and this has an unknown fiscal impact in both biennia. Line 15 of the spreadsheet is the income tax discharge debt subtraction for coerced debt awarded to a debtor. And this is estimated to have a negative negligible impact. Line 16 of the spreadsheet, there are changes to the allocation and the timing of the beginning farmer tax credit. This is estimated to not have a fiscal impact. And then I will move on to the corporate tax section, which is at the top of page 3, and there is one change, and this is the housing tax on line 27, the housing tax credit carryover. That is a bill that was heard and that has no fiscal impact. This provision just allows the remaining $9.9 million that was not allocated in 23 to be allocated in 2024. All right, and then at the middle of the page, on page 3, we have sales tax changes. And on line 41, the first one is the construction exemption for purchases of materials. And this is for the city of Woodbury for the water treatment facility. And the bill, as heard in committee, had a revenue reduction for fiscal 25, 26, and 27. The tax bill allows the exemption for fiscal 25 only. I should also mention the tax committee heard Representative Wiener's bill for Browerville and the school district, and that was heard as a sales tax exemption. That provision was converted to an appropriation, and that will be discussed in the Ms. Highmark's portion of the spreadsheet. Line 42 of the spreadsheet is the exemption for the coin-operated amusement devices. This has a an unknown impact in the current biennium and in the tails to sales tax. And then moving to page 5, all the way to page 5, there are changes in the other net tax revenues area. Again, on line 114, we see the coin-operated amusement device gross receipts tax. On this line, the revenue gain is unknown for the establishment of this tax in both biennium. On line 115 of the spreadsheet, there is the repeal of the controlled substances and illegal substances tax, and that is estimated to have a negligible impact in fiscal 24 and 25, and an estimated revenue reduction of 10,000 in the tails. And then finally, on line 116 of the spreadsheet, there is, Mr. Williams mentioned, there is an additional one-time dedication in the solid for the waste reduction and recycling, and this has the effect of reducing the allocation to the general fund. So this has a cost of $1.82 million in fiscal 25 only, and that covers all of the tax revenues portion of the spreadsheet. Ms. Highmark will cover the property tax area.
Excellent. Before we move over to Ms. Highmark, are there any questions about Ms. Templin's side of the spreadsheet? Not seeing any, please proceed.
Madam Chair and members, Katrina Highmark, House Fiscal. I want to bring your attention that the signs reverse on the property tax side of the spreadsheet. So if you're seeing a positive number, that is actually a cost. And if you're seeing a negative number, it is a cost savings. Similar to my colleague, Ms. Templin, I will only be focusing on the change items in the bill. You can see current law will be highlighted within the spreadsheet. Within the property tax refunds category, the creation of land value taxation districts has a unknown fiscal impact. It's unknown whether that would be a net positive or a net negative.
Sorry, I don't want to interrupt you. We're on page 6.
I'm sorry.
Right?
Yes, we are on page 6.
Okay, great. Just so everybody's
line
looking
5.
At the right.
Thank you.
Page. Please proceed. Thank you, Ms.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Line 6 is the property tax abatement for land bank property. And this has a property tax refund interaction of $20,000 in fiscal year 26 and 27. Line 9 is the property tax exemption for the Red Lake Nation Tribal College, which has a fiscal impact of $122,000 in fiscal year 25. Lines 10 and 11 present the property tax exemption for the Grand Portage Band, those 5 parcels. This has a cost reduction of for the school building bond credit that is negligible, and a cost increase for the property tax refund interaction, which is negligible. So this all cancels out. Moving forward, the Homestead Resort property tax modifications has a $30,000 impact in fiscal years 26 and 27. The property tax exemption for the Leech Lake Band in Minneapolis has an impact of $10,000 in fiscal year 26 and 27. The Class 4D2 property modifications for community land trusts has a cost savings of $460,000 in fiscal years 26 and 27. The public charity exemption modification for rental housing, as well as the advanced property tax refund for seniors, have no fiscal impact here. I do want to highlight that the advanced property tax refund does have an administrative cost, which is tracked in a separate section of this spreadsheet. The Cooperative Association's electrical distribution systems exemption has a cost of $60,000 in the tails. Moving on to page 7. The discharge debt subtraction will have a positive, a negative, a savings, negligible impact starting in fiscal year 25 through the tails. Moving to our next series of changes, that's line 43 through 45, we have a one-time aid increase to counties for local homeless prevention aid, as well as a one-time aid increase to our tribal nations here in Minnesota, which results in a $5 million cost in fiscal year 25. Moving on to page 8. At the bottom of page 8, line 75, is that aid to cities one time for the Emerald Ash Borer financial assistance of $1 million in fiscal year 2025. Then we have the taconite aid reimbursement. If we look at page 9, line 85, the taconite aid reimbursement actually results in a net savings for the general fund of $1.7 million in the tails. Moving forward to page 10. The next change item is the penalty forgiveness for the City of Stewart. Given that the aid to the City of Stewart was withheld and the forgiveness will be taking place within the same year, then this is a net neutral. This is a zero cost impact. Ms. Templin highlighted that Representative Wiener's bill that we heard regarding Browerville Public Schools, the grant is tracked in my part of the spreadsheet. We have a cost impact of $580,000 in fiscal year 25. There is a one-time grant to South St. Paul, that's line 131, of $100,000 in fiscal year 24, and a grant to Anoka County Soil and Water Conservation District of $50,000 in fiscal year 25. We're coming into the home stretch. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Ms. Templin, for a few of the items and regarding the non-property tax expenditures and transfers.
Thank you. On page 11, line 148 of the spreadsheet and 149 of the spreadsheet, here are the transfers to the child care tax credit account on line 148. There is a general fund cost for the transfer of $32.3 million. And on line 149 of the spreadsheet, it shows the transfer into the general fund for the cost of the child tax credit in fiscal 26 and 27. And then on line 150 of the spreadsheet, there's an appropriation for the advanced property tax refund for seniors. This is for the DOR administration. This has a cost of $158,000 in fiscal 24 and 25. And a cost of $234,000 in 26 and 27. Moving on to line 151, there is an appropriation for the political contribution refund electronic requirements. This also has an administrative cost to DOR of $147,000 in 24 and 25 and $118,000 in 26 and 27. And then on line 152 of the spreadsheet, there is an appropriation for the direct free file system for the individual income tax system. There is an appropriation of $5 million in fiscal 25. And then in fiscal 27, there is an appropriation of $2.3 million in that year. And then on line 153 of the spreadsheet, there is the repeal of the tax modernization account in the special revenue fund. That the cancellation of that account has a general fund savings of $5 million in fiscal 25. And then on line 154 of this spreadsheet, there is an appropriation for the tax credit outreach grants of $1,025,000 in fiscal 25. And an appropriation of $1,044,000 in fiscal 26 and $1,045,000 in fiscal 27. Turning the page to page 12, at the top there is an appropriation to the taxpayer assistance grants. This is a cost of $750,000 each year.
line 157 of the spreadsheet, there's an appropriation for the corporate tax base erosion study. What you see in the spreadsheet is the cost for the bill as it was heard in committee. And then on line 58 of the spreadsheet, there's an appropriation for the corporate franchise tax disclosure requirements. This has a cost of, of $480,000 in fiscal 24 and fiscal 25, and $396,000 in fiscal 26 and 27. And then finally, on line 159 of the spreadsheet, there is also an appropriation to the state auditor of $387,000 in fiscal 25 and $703,000 in fiscal 26 and 27.
I want to conclude by noting that the total cost for the property tax aids and credits in fiscal 24 and 25 would be $5.524 billion, and the total cost in fiscal year 26 and 27 would be $4.622 billion.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for our fiscal staff, Representative Swedzinski?
Thank you, Chair Goldman. And just moving kind of back to the on page six, property tax for the tribes, there's no cost to that? Is it just spreading the cost to other taxpayers through that exemption, or is the state actually going to pay for that local property tax on behalf of the tribes? Is that why there's no cost to it?
Ms. Highmark.
Representative Swedzinski, given that there are several property tax exemptions for the different tribes, I would appreciate if you could be specific as to which one you're referring to.
Thank you.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just pretty much any of the line 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, there's negligible or small amounts of property tax. There's no real cost to these bills. And so is it simply that what are they currently paying for property taxes? And maybe that's in the bill that I didn't see see because it didn't come before here. But what's the cost, and then how much tax is going to be, is somebody going to hoist that on other local property taxpayers? What's going on with that?
Ms. Highmark.
Representative Swedzinski, to clarify, as you can see, there are different interactions, and my understanding is that the different property tax interactions demonstrate that there would be a shifting of the cost of those exemptions onto other properties.
Thank you.
Representative Swedzinski.
Madam Chair, is there a staff or maybe the folks that carry those bills, could they explain how much increased taxes will be placed on other property taxpayers in those jurisdictions? Do we know that?
No. Just Representative Swedzinski, if I could, just since property taxes are levied by local jurisdictions, by counties, we don't have that specific information for this except in the case of the Red Lake Nation Tribal College, where it is on the where there's that direct general fund cost. So the only general fund costs that usually get tracked when there's a property tax shift are these PTR interactions. And so this will be common for any kind of policy decision that results in a property tax shift. There isn't a cost to the general fund. And so it doesn't show up on our spreadsheets. I think, if you, I'm just trying to think. I feel like we could ask, those counties if you need specific information about what the property tax liability is in the, current year for these parcels. Maybe that's something we could follow up on. But I don't, our fiscal staff isn't going to track those county shifts or what the value or what the tax liability for those parcels is.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I'm just looking at, we kind of say, well, it's really no cost, but it does cost someone something when we're making these property cost shifts. It's going to increase the amount of burden in those local jurisdictions for higher property tax, regardless whether it's a bill that I'm carrying on veterans for a VFW or whatever. But it'd be just interesting to see, like, if we were to say, all right, if our goal of this legislature is to exempt tribal nations from paying property taxes outside of their current areas that they have a vast majority of their populations, what is that cost to those local jurisdictions? What are they incurring to house these
businesses or schools or whatever. I'm not sure what these properties are exactly that we're exempting. And, you know, if that's continuation, like, are we going to be doing that with different, like, hotels? So are we going to be putting other hotels at a disadvantage that aren't owned by tribal entities within these areas? So, like, from, like, Intercontinental and St. Paul, like, is this going to be kind of a continuation? Like, if a tribal entity owns something, will they, you know, is that starting that process? And just, you know, just general kind of questions along those lines.
So yeah, the answer to those kind of questions, I mean, I think it's a good line of inquiry because there are tribally controlled entities that operate businesses, and those activities are not exempt. So in these specific cases, you know, the 4301 is a college, which is an exempt activity. The one for Grand Portage is parcels that are, I think they're like empty. They're like, or not empty. I think they're there isn't any kind of structure or any. There's certainly no revenue-creating activity taking place on them because the intent is not to exempt, you know, tribal entities from property taxes when they're engaging in, you know, revenue-creating activity outside of their reservation boundaries. For example, the example you gave with the Intercontinental Hotel, which is owned by, I think, Mille Lacs? I can't remember. And then, you know, line 15, the Censor Mura exemption for the Leech Lake Band is, I believe it's a number of different tribes have basically like embassies in Minneapolis. Certainly we have a number of them. So that, you know, the tribe will basically operate a government building in outside of the bounds of their reservation, but like to serve their residents that live in our city. And so like other government buildings, those activities are exempt. And so just with these in general, you know, the intent is to ensure that when, you know, a tribal entity has these parcels for which like the purpose that they're being used is an exempt purpose, that they're not paying property taxes on them. You know, I think that there was sort of a little bit of a question about this, like if the use changed, that if you know, they were to move from using it for a purpose that's an exempt purpose, a government purpose or a school, and they were like, oh, we want to open up, instead of our tribal college, we're going to open up a hotel there, that I believe that we added some safeguards for that. And if we didn't, then we certainly can. I'll just double check with staff after this because I this is a conversation that came up in the property tax division, and I think it's valid, and it's not certainly our intent to have people who are, you know, entities that are doing revenue creating activities be exempt. So thank you. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just looking at the line 155, page 12 of the spreadsheet, your bill for local sales tax authorizations, mm-hmm. Was there an estimate of how much local sales tax that authorization might be expected to generate?
Line 155 on page
12.
159. So that the appropriation, that's the appropriation to the state auditor for administration of, well, so sorry, can you just restate your question?
Yeah, well, I understand that the $387,000, that's to the state auditors to authorize local units of government to raise local sales tax and not utilize the current procedure going through the legislature. But my question is, do you know, like, have an estimate of how much local sales taxes may be raised through the new?
No.
I thought maybe you'd said something like $2.5 billion in state gov, but I just wanted to verify.
No, that was those were the previous authorizations. So until we know who's applying for, you know, or until we know who's implementing a local sales tax, then we don't really have an estimate of how much that amount would be.
I will just note for you that the amount of $2.5 billion, those were proposals that were put forward by Democrats and by Republicans. And, you know, so it's like I kind of talked about when I was giving an overview of the policy. It's kind of, you know, viewed as a way to say, oh, we're not raising taxes, but you're really raising taxes. So, but if you, you know, I gave you that number knowing that you would want to try to weaponize it against me, but please look forward to talking about it more on the floor.
Madam Chair and committee members, I appreciate the clarification.
Thank you for your participation, Representative Posnick. Is there any, before we move to the lead to kind of close us out for the day, are there any further questions about, Ms. Highmark?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that we did have two more pages on our spreadsheet of the non-general fund.
Oh, man, I'm sorry. I thought we were at the end here. Let's go back. No, I want to spend as much time as possible with you guys. You know that. Ms. Highmark, please proceed. My apologies if I interrupted you.
You did not, Madam Chair. I just want to start off by saying that on this part of the spreadsheet, to keep everyone on their toes, we're going to switch the signs once again. And positive numbers represent revenue gains, and negative numbers represent revenue losses or expenditures. And I will pass it over to my colleague, Ms. Templin.
Thank you. And basically, the signs are the same as what you see in revenue estimates on this section of the tracking sheet. On lines two and three of the spreadsheet, there the tax bill includes a provision that fixes the rate at 0.5% for the provider tax research credit. This has a zero impact to the healthcare access fund. Lines four through five of the spreadsheet, we have discussed these provisions in the general funds section of the spreadsheet, but there's also a special revenue fund impact in fiscal 24 and 25 of $32.3 million of revenue raised to the special revenue fund in that biennium, and a cost of $32.3 million of revenue reduction to that fund for that account. Lines 7 and 8 of the spreadsheet reflect the tax modernization account. This is, there's a cancellation of that account, which has savings to the special revenue fund in fiscal 25. Lines 9 through 12 of the spreadsheet pertain to the local sales tax authorization language in the tax bill. There are special revenue funds for the Department of Revenue and for the state auditor that will get 1% of the proceeds for administration. There is no fiscal cost in the spreadsheet that's being tracked right now because we do not have an estimate of how much revenue will be raised. And then lines 13 through 16 of the spreadsheet reflect the sales tax provisions that affect the general fund. They also affect the legacy fund accounts, and there's a corresponding interaction. And the interaction, I won't go through each line unless you want me to, is reflected on lines 14, 15, and 16. And then finally, on line 17 of the spreadsheet, there is a revenue increase to the environmental fund because of the provision for the one-time dedication for waste reduction and recycling of $1.821 million in fiscal 25 only. And Ms. Highmark will finish the other non-general fund accounts.
Thank you, Ms. Templin. Starting with line 19 up to lines 32, these are funds and accounts that relate to Article 3, the minerals taxes article. I want to highlight lines 19 and 20. I mentioned the Taconite Homestead Credit Adjustment on line 86 in the property tax portion of the spreadsheet, which had a general fund savings. Here we can see that the Taconite Homestead Credit Adjustment does have a cost to the Taconite Property Tax Relief Fund, which is responsible for paying for those property tax refunds. The additional The additional funds, the range association of municipalities and schools accounts, all the way down to the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Fund on the final page of the spreadsheet. The majority of those are transfers between accounts reflecting increases to production tax deposits in the case of the RAMS account or transfers between accounts. The exception would be line 25, the City of Chisholm, the Senator David Tomasoni Bridge of Peace, which has an expenditure of $300,000 in fiscal year 25. So with that, I am ready to stand for questions.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ms. Highmark, Ms. Templin. Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a general question, too, kind of going back to that IRRRB portion. Is that those funds that are going to be paying, is it only, maybe this would be a question to Representative Listergaard, is that only homesteaded properties, or is it, would it count towards rental properties? Would it count to just, so it's only a homesteaded property? All right, sounds good. Go ahead.
Okay, Representative Listergaard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the representative, yes, only homestead.
Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is there currently that portion? Is that a brand new kind of an aspect to the property tax relief in that area, or is that a continuation or expansion?
Chair Listergaard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I believe it's been 26 years, don't quote me, since the last time it's been adjusted. If you live outside, and this is all in the taconite relief area, I believe that anyone outside of a city in the taconite relief area gets $289.90 credit, and anyone in a city gets $315. What we did is straight across the board, anyone that is in the TRA all receives $515 permanently.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excellent. All right. Are there any other questions before we move to Lee Davids? Representative Swidzinski.
Sorry, just a general, you know, thank you, Madam Chair. And just kind of a, so if it's a flat rate, Representative Listergaard, does it take into account of actual taxes paid? So, like, let's say if your property tax bill is $300 for a property, will you receive more money, or do you, are you capped at actual cost of property?
You can find this provision on excuse me, page 45, line 25 of the DE, where it sets the maximum reduction at 515. Chair Listergaard?
Thank you. No, you do not get paid to live in your home if you don't pay that. It is a up to a certain maximum percentage. The whole point is, and we'll, and I can't wait for the discussion, this is transformational for the people of the Iron Range. So, tomorrow, I don't know, I hope that they're there to talk about where the money is generated and where the poorest communities. There are two districts that produce the revenue currently, and those are the two poorest districts, and that is what the focus is. This is going to be a transformational bill for Northeast Minnesota and the people who need it most.
Right. Representative Swidzinski. All right. Any further discussion? Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Couple, some would say minor issues, some would say if it's their bill, they're major issues. But on page 10 of 14, 129, I want to thank the chair and previous chairs for the penalty forgiveness for the city of Stewart. Some years ago, as chair, we could have 20 to 23 cities coming in asking for forgiveness. And we got a little, we let it be known how things should be. And I noticed there's one, so good job on that. Line 130, I really like the way you did that. That's quite creative. It doesn't open the door up for necessarily things in the future, so they can't come back and say, well, you did it for them. I think that's a creative way to handle that issue. And I'd really like to thank House Research and Fiscal for a very good presentation today. Look forward to the next couple of days.
All right.
Of course, Madam Chair, I also look forward to root canals.
Just kidding.
Thank you, Lee Davids. With that, so we're going to kind of continue to work with these same materials over the next couple days. Yep. If you want to take your House research summary, I understand, to study it, please bring it back so that we're not printing a bunch of unnecessary copies. And with that, we will be back tomorrow to accept public testimony on the bill, and we are adjourned.